Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So Katie, Theresa May is not talking about Europe today. What's she talking about instead?
She's giving the climate a go, and specifically climate change. So she's in Paris and she is expected to announce basically a raft of new policies, measures or initiatives, depending on how much money you need for each one to fit into each category. And this includes, I think, £140 million to help developing countries tackle climate change and schemes, also plans to team up with Canada more on these things. And I think the general theme coming from these, rather than any one specific, is this big push by the government to be seen as greener. And also specifically with these ones, it's almost like she is stepping away or distancing herself from perhaps the Trump agenda, and attaching herself more to the European agenda, which is to really tackle climate change, something which obviously isn't associated with, you know, Donald Trump's team. So I think it's her attempt to show her European allies that she is, you know, still, they might not be a member of the European Union in a year to come, but she still has shared goals.
James, David Cameron promised to make his government the greenest government ever. Do you think Theresa May is going to do any better than he did? He didn't really stick to that when it turned out that voters weren't as interested in that pledge as he thought they were.
I think it is back to the Tory detoxification strategy, which is, if you remember back when David Cameron first became Tory leader in those early local elections, he said, vote blue, go green. And the idea was to say, look, we're not the nasty party anymore. We care about the environment. We care about animals. We're nice, really. I think you see the Tories trying to do the same thing again now. You know, you saw the other night the kind of coordinated Tory MPs tweeting about Blue Planet, saying, ah, look, we're watching Blue Planet with lovable David Attenborough and we want to deal with these problems too. So I think there's a lot of that going on. I think Katie's also right, but there's a real determination on the part of the UK government at the moment in international forums to kind of reassure the EU, look, we are not going to turn into Trump-style America the moment after we leave. So you see Philip Hammond signing that letter with a whole bunch of other European finance ministers, having a go at the proposed Trump tax cuts in the US and what they would mean for double taxation treaties and the like. So I think it's a combination of detoxification at home and reassuring the EU, which is driving this current green focus.
They haven't had a great deal of success on some fronts, though, have they, Katie? They did have to clarify that they did still believe that animals had feelings.
Yeah, there was an animal sentience story that went viral, and it was a misleading story that Independent ran about this amendment to the Brexit bill. But again, I think that's kind of just hardened their determination to really try and pitch themselves as this. And kind of, you mentioned earlier the idea that perhaps David Cameron concluded there aren't votes in this, but I think the Conservatives have really decided there are votes in this. There are a lot of votes, and the votes that they need if they've got any hope of staying in power. And there was really interesting research by Bright Blue, the think tank, over the summer, which found that among young voters, if you go the youngest bracket, so 18 to 24, the environment is the issue they care about the most. And among younger voters, if you expand that, is the second after, you know, the NHS.
James, how is Michael Gove doing as Environment Secretary?
Well, it's the classic Gove effect. You drop him into a department and lots of things start happening. Now, I think you see he's handling this brief though much more like he handled the justice brief and he handled the education brief. He's very keen to kind of bring all the dread word, all the stakeholders along with him. And I think you see some kind of cognitive dissonance. You've got George Monbiot saying, I can't quite believe I'm saying this, but Michael Gove is the Environment Secretary who's doing and saying all the things that I've been hoping and praying that someone would do. You also, I think, one of the lessons the Tories took from the last election was they were really hurt by the lack of third-party endorsements. And you can see all the time, you know, that there are, you know, groups coming out saying, oh, you know, very good, you know, London Zoo coming out to praise Gove on plastics, you know, lots of people liking the stuff he's done with beavers in the Forest of Dean. You know, this is all designed to create a kind of a slightly different feel around the Tory party than existed at the last election, you know, trying to take some of the kind of harder edges off that kind of Toryism.
So let's move along the cabinet table, Katie, to David Davis. How's he doing as Brexit Secretary?
Well, he's really proving that he was right yesterday when he said you don't have to be clever or particularly on, you know, on the details to be Brexit Secretary. Don't think it necessarily means that you're going to be a good Brexit Secretary, but it does mean you're not going to get fired, which is what we've seen in the past few days when David Davis appeared on the Andrew Marr show, appeared to almost slightly show off when he talked about this draft agreement of sufficient progress. And he said, don't worry, I mean, it's not actually legal enforceable. It's more, you know, it's much more just a kind of an agreement of intent. This... perhaps unsurprisingly, rattled a few people concern before this is even, you know, reaches the final stage of sufficient progress being agreed, which is at the end of this week. And then he was sent back on the airwaves yesterday on LBC, where he appeared to change his tune. And he said that he did mean it was legally enforceable. And now we're seeing the European Parliament really pushing to have this agreement kind of locked down in a much harder term so it is legally enforceable, because they are blaming David Davis and saying his comments have undermined trust in the whole negotiations, which means that you might now have to see it much more firm, which is very kind of unnecessary to the whole tone of these negotiations, given the amount of work the Prime Minister had to put in last week to get to sufficient progress.
James, David Davis might be right in saying you don't have to be clever to be Brexit Secretary, but you do seem to have to be careful, given that your words will be seized upon by those on the other side of the negotiations. Do you think he's safe in his job?
Yes, I do, because I think if you were to move him, unless you could find a way to promote him, you'd basically be saying that the whole negotiating strategy had been wrong. And I don't think Theresa May is going to do that. Again, David Davis is also one of those cabinet ministers whom Theresa May has kind of personal responsibility for, in a way, because she chose to bring him back from the backbenches. You know, he hadn't been a particularly leading figure in the referendum campaign. And she, to his surprise and everyone else's surprise, then decided to offer him the plum job of Brexit Secretary. I think there's another lesson for the UK government in what's happened here, though, which is the European Parliament are desperate not to be the third wheel in this process. They are desperate to find some role for themselves. And, I mean, he's walked into their trap in justifying that. But I think the UK government needs to be very careful about this, because the European Parliament are going to get a vote on the eventual deal. And I think there's a kind of view in Whitehall of, oh, well, of course they won't cause any trouble. I wouldn't put it past them. You know, it's the old Brussels joke, has it? They are monkeys with guns. And I think they we would be the UK government would be well advised to have a kind of diplomatic charm offence for the European Parliament. You know, few invitations to nice receptions and all the like. Just and a really conspicuous attempt to say that the UK is taking the European Parliament very seriously in this process. Because I think if the European Parliament feel disrespected, they'll be quite inclined to throw a spanner in the works if they can.
Katie, what sort of mood is the wider Tory party in? Are they broadly supportive of David Davis, or are they going into Christmas in a big grump?
Well, I think in general they're quite boosted, and I was speaking to one MP last night who basically said, on the Eurosceptic wing of the party, and he said, it's amazing. A couple of days ago, you thought it might be the end of Theresa May. And now she looks like she's in a stronger position than ever and she can do no wrong. And so it flips around like that. Now that she does, since she managed to get sufficient progress at the final hour, it has really turned around her fortunes. And I think that there are a lot of people who are still sceptical of David Davis, but they have renewed trust in the Prime Minister to lead it. So if she were to keep him, then they'll be fine. I do think the Brexit impact assessment report shenanigans last week have really damaged his personal standing, which again might be good news for Theresa May, because often Davis is talked about as a caretaker Prime Minister. And I say, if anything, he's gone down and she's gone up.
I also think he's been slightly cut out of the process. There was a very telling tweet from Jeremy Hayward after sufficient progress was... Jean-Claude Juncker said, you've got sufficient progress. And Jeremy Hayward sent a tweet saying, congratulations to Ollie Robbins and all the officials working on this. Ollie Robbins is obviously the number 10 Sherpa who was in Dexu, then fell out with David Davis and now works exclusively for number 10. And it did suggest that the Department for Exit in the European Union had not actually been as relevant as perhaps you would think it would be in this negotiation.
So what's the point in setting it up then?
I think that you can't... I think in a way, we get onto one of my other bugbears here. But the civil service have handled this very badly. I mean, setting up this whole other department was not a good idea. It has not worked. You now see them trying to recreate the old number 10 / cabinet office structure for dealing with the EU again. And I think it is worth reflecting on the resignation of Bob Kerslake as the head of the King's NHS Hospital Trust in London, in that this guy was head of a Home Civil Service, and it now turns out that he's not competent to run an NHS hospital trust. I mean, what does that tell us about the quality of some of the leadership in Whitehall? I mean, that is really quite damning.
Let's just talk about Bob Kerslake quickly, Katie. He made a big noise over the weekend about stepping down, and then it was suggested that actually he'd already been told to go. Is there anything that's damaging in this for the government?
I think first off with Vukasik, the thing is he is well known to be advising Jeremy Corbyn on, you know, the transition if they were to become government, which means that already the sting is taken out slightly, because not only can you say, oh, they're Labour-leaning, they're like actively seem to be helping a Corbyn government, which is probably a step further. I think what is damaging, and this is a similar thing that happened with Adam Milburn and the resignation, is Number 10 just seem a bit behind the curve on these things. If you are really asking people to consider their positions, surely you could see that they might go out, you know, in the swan dance where they're going to like take the most political capital they can from stepping down and spin it on their own terms. Yet they keep seeming to be caught out if that is really what's happening.
I've been following Momentum on Instagram because, you know, my life isn't exciting enough already. And I noticed that they were making quite a big deal of Bob Kerslake, you know, with a little filter over the top and some hashtags. But I thought it was interesting how the left are using it, and probably a bit like the animal sentience story, it can still be something that has quite a lot of power, even if it's not necessarily true. James, do you think the Conservatives have responded to his resignation well?
No, in that, as Katie says, they should have been aware that this was going to come, and they should never have allowed to get to a situation where he could initially portray his resignation as all being about him saying, you can't run NHS services on this amount of money. The other thing they need to be aware of is that Bob Kerslake might not be the most competent public servant ever. I think we can all agree on that. But there is a broader question about what the NHS can do with the current levels of resources. And how do you know, the continual lack of integration between NHS and social care, and also just the demands on the health service, you know, which, and can it get through this winter? I think there is a big question which we will need to have at some point, which Jeremy Hunt is trying to get going, about whether ultimately health spending needs to go up. I think one of the problems with how health spending went up in the new Labour years was because it was kind of telegraphed and all done at once, a huge amount of it got swallowed up in pay and increased bureaucracy. But whether a more gradual stepping up of health spending levels to get closer to the French and German levels might actually be necessary in time.
And Katie, things aren't all doom and gloom for the Conservatives, are they? They've had some good news in the polls for once.
Yeah, not just one, but two polls in the past 24 hours.
It's like Christmas has come early.
Exactly. Have, unfortunately, just after the staff party. So, have found that the Tories are for the first time ahead of Labour since the snap election. I think one of them has them ahead by 1 point, and maybe the other one has them ahead by 2 points.
So it's not exactly a storming lead.
It's not a storming lead. And also, I mean, it's enough of a... It doesn't suggest they're really edging ahead, but what it does show you is that they are truly neck and neck, Labour and the Tories, if you're taking these polls. And this idea that Labour had all this momentum and in more ways than one, and were like slowly, you know, like getting ahead and, you know, overtaking, it doesn't seem to be working.
I mean, look, who knows if these polls are accurate or not? I mean, we all should treat them with a large amount of salt, but the psychological effect of Westminster is very important. I also think that it will begin to change the narrative, which is you'll see people will start, you know, it's been a whispered conversation at Westminster, you know, should Labour be doing better? But you wonder whether that will become more vocal and whether some of those Labour moderates who had felt very cowed by the general election result and have basically shut up since then, whether you'll begin to see people kind of clearing their throat and starting to say, hang on a second, what's going on here? Why aren't we doing better? The government have not had, you wouldn't think that the government had a particularly good few months, but they seem to be ticking back up in the polls. I think one other final psychological effect is it takes the wind out of the idea of any kind of early leadership challenge to Theresa May, in that you can already hear her allies spreading around among MPs saying, look, got through the budget, everyone said it wouldn't be possible to do that, got sufficient progress, everyone said it wouldn't be possible to do that, we got back ahead in the polls. And if Damien Green does survive this cabinet office investigation, indeed, you can imagine that she might get to finally do a voluntary reshuffle. And I don't think it would be particularly dramatic, but it would be enough to kind of suggest that she has authority, bring on some more younger talent. You know, you can begin to see how they can make the situation look more normal.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And a reminder that you can listen to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes Store. And we have a special Christmas offer for our listeners. You can get an annual subscription to The Spectator for £99. It normally costs £135 and we'll throw in a lovely bottle of Berry Brothers champagne. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Christmas podcast offer. Thanks for listening.